So if you were here last Sunday morning, you may remember that we began a short new series, a series entitled Temptations Jesus Faced. Temptations Jesus Faced. And remember then, we're not confining ourselves in this series to the obvious passage. The passage in which Jesus is there in the wilderness being tempted. Of the four temptations that we're considering in this series, only one of them is from there, the one that we looked at last week, that proposal uttered by the devil, "Fall down and worship me." So as for the temptation that we're looking at this week, if you want to reduce it to a single line, I guess it would be that line in Mark chapter 1, verse 37, the words of Jesus' disciples to him early one Sunday morning: "Everyone is looking for you. Everyone is looking for you." I have three headings to structure our thoughts. And first of all, then, a role that's enticing. A role, R-O-L-E, that's enticing. Now, in and of itself, that line I just mentioned, Mark chapter 1, verse 37, it might sound innocuous, even quite encouraging. Surely it's a good thing that Jesus here is wanted. A bit later on, in chapter 5 of this gospel and verse 17, Mark describes a bunch of people begging Jesus to depart from their region. They can't wait to see the back of him. That's a depressing spectacle if ever there was one. Surely this, on the other hand, is a lovely thing to observe. Jesus is in demand. But before we can properly interpret verses 35 to 37, we need to get a sense of what's going on in verses 21 to 34 of this chapter. The setting throughout that section is Capernaum. It's the Sabbath day. Capernaum, in the first century, was about the size of Long Framlington, that place that you pass through on the road to Wooler in Northumberland, where some of you will no doubt be in a couple of months' time for the annual convention there. So in our terms, Capernaum was a decent-sized village. Now, I don't know what the vibe was generally like in Capernaum. Situated on the shoreline of the Sea of Galilee, it was a centre for fishing. I mean commercial fishing in boats, not guys sitting on a pier with their rods. And so I suspect then it was a busy little place, large quantities of fish constantly being brought in, lots of selling and buying going on of this staple first century Galilean food. But if it was that kind of lively hub Sunday to Friday, the situation, of course, would have been very different on the Sabbath. On the Sabbath, everything in Capernaum would have ground to a halt. The pace of life would have lessened considerably. Capernaum on the Sabbath would have been a sleepy, sedentary spot with little going on. But not on this Sabbath. This Sabbath, described in verses 21 to 34, is a very different kind of Sabbath than usual. There may not be any boats coming and going in the harbour. There may not be any fish market open with sellers shouting out what they've got and customers jostling and bartering. In terms of trade and commerce, the normal weekly shutdown may be in operation, but all the same, the atmosphere in Capernaum this Sabbath is electric. The place is buzzing. The excitement is palpable. Why? How come the usual stillness isn't there this particular Sabbath? Well, this is why. Jesus mania has gripped the town. Throughout its streets and its squares, there's a feverish fascination with Jesus and his supernatural powers. It all begins in the synagogue. Jesus is teaching there. And even with his teaching, actually, he's already making quite an impression and astonishing the locals, verse 22. But the real spark that ignites the mass frenzy and hysteria, it occurs when Jesus is interrupted in his teaching. He's interrupted by a man with an unclean spirit. For most of us, I guess, that would be a pretty formidable kind of interruption. I think it's fair to say that I'd be a little freaked out if a demon suddenly reared its head in the morning service here. But Jesus isn't freaked out. With a simple one-line rebuke, he sends the demon packing. And that, as I say, is what really sets things ablaze. In a stroke, Jesus is propelled into superstardom. Verse 27, they were all amazed, so that they questioned among themselves, saying, "What is this? A new teaching with authority. He commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him." And at once his fame spread everywhere throughout all the surrounding region of Galilee. Jesus himself then exits the public domain for perhaps a few hours. He's inside a house with some of his disciples, but his absence does nothing to calm the situation. The craze triggered by the incident in the synagogue doesn't abate. It gathers momentum. The people of Capernaum don't think to themselves, "Well, that was an interesting Sabbath morning," and retire quietly to their homes. Rather, they think, "He can do miracles. He can heal Uncle Albert's gout. He can cure Cousin Bertie's paralysis. We need to get them to the front of the queue." Simultaneously, hundreds of minds fasten on the same kind of thought. So that when evening comes, Jesus opens the front door of the house where he's been for the last few hours, and the most extraordinary scene greets him. Verse 32, that evening at sundown, they brought to him all who were sick or oppressed by demons, and the whole city was gathered at the door. Imagine it. And having taken it in for a few minutes, Jesus then starts to walk along that endless, snaking line of people. And with a word here and a gentle touch there, and sometimes just a glance of his eyes perhaps, ailments and disabilities are dispelled, limbs and organs are restored. And as miracle follows miracle in rapid, breathless succession, every moment there's another stunned gasp, another face suddenly sodden with joyful tears. Many just stare at Jesus in almost disbelieving awe. It seems to all these people that with Jesus present, their town has become a utopia. A fantastical, illness-free zone. It seems like Capernaum is a wonderful little paradise, safe from disaster and distress, with Jesus inhabiting its streets. And thus, they finally head to their homes late that night, pinching themselves and walking on air. They then wake up the next morning, and it's while breakfast is still being prepared across Capernaum's kitchens that rumours start to circulate. Rumours that Jesus has disappeared. And suddenly the elation starts to drain away. Suddenly people start to feel rather vulnerable. If Jesus has disappeared, then all life's problems that last night seemed a thing of the past, they could come flooding back. If Jesus has disappeared, Uncle Albert's gout might be replaced by something else, even nastier than the gout that he had before. If Jesus has disappeared, Cousin Bertie, now free from the paralysis and back already on the fishing boats, he might fall overboard someday and drown or something. If Jesus has disappeared, who knows what might happen? All kinds of undesirable things might suddenly strike. We need Jesus to stay here. And when then Simon and co come to Jesus and say in verse 37, "Everyone is looking for you," what that means is Capernaum wants its illness healer and demon banisher and general problem solver back. Capernaum wants to carry on benefiting from your supernatural powers. Capernaum is desperate for that, Jesus. So that I think we can say that for Jesus, who remember from last week has come into the world to do what? To die on a cross. I think we can say that for Jesus, a different kind of role from that is opening up here. A very different kind of role from that. The role of being Capernaum's resident miracle performer. The role of being a full-time wonder worker for these people who so appreciate all that he's done amongst them. And that's the role then that I'm saying in my heading is enticing. It's enticing for Jesus, most of all, of course, for the same reason that that temptation in the wilderness we looked at last week was enticing, because it's an immeasurably less demanding role that's opening up for him here than that of dying on a cross. being Capernaum's miracle worker, being their resident healer and demon banisher, well, that's rather pleasanter, isn't it, than going to Golgotha and being a sacrifice for the sins of the world. But it's enticing too, because it's so near to being right, even while it's so far from being right. I think actually we compare this moment with another that Mark records just a couple of chapters later. If you just turn over to chapter 3, and look at verse 20 of chapter 3. Then he, that's Jesus, went home, and the crowd gathered again, so that they could not even eat. And then this, when his family heard it, they went out to seize him, for they were saying, he is out of his mind. Then jump to verse 31. And his mother, Jesus' mother and his brothers came, and standing outside, they sent to him and called him. And a crowd was sitting around him, and they said to him, your mother and your brothers are outside seeking you. The Greek word there in verse 32 is the same as back in chapter 1, verse 37. Everyone is looking for you. Your mother and your brothers are outside seeking you, looking for you. Same Greek word. And I don't think that's coincidental. I think there's a similarity between these two incidents. As his family members seek him in chapter 3 in order to take him in hand and bring him back to Nazareth to be under their supervision, it doesn't seem on the surface unreasonable that Jesus should comply. He could plausibly justify such compliance on the basis of the fifth commandment and the importance of honoring his mother. And in the same way as the people of Capernaum seek him here in chapter 1, in order to retain him as their healer and exorcist, it doesn't seem on the surface unreasonable that Jesus should comply. He could plausibly justify such compliance on the basis that healing and casting out demons are good activities, merciful activities that liberate poor, burdened, pitiful men and women, activities indeed that in a real way preview the great day of redemption at the end of time when all God's people will be set free from illness and from demons. But Jesus mustn't return to that quiet life with his family back home in Nazareth. And he mustn't settle down in Capernaum as a practitioner of the supernatural, because Calvary beckons for him. Golgotha is his destiny. Offering himself as a bloody, sin-bearing sacrifice is his mission. These alternative paths would be disastrous. They are a million miles away from the path he's called to walk as God's Messiah, but they don't seem a million miles away, I'm saying. As I said a moment ago, they are so near to being right, even while they are so far from being right. And they are enticing, therefore. The role that the people of Capernaum want Jesus to fulfill here, it's not a tawdry, unseemly, indecent kind of role. No, if they have their way, Jesus will be continually alleviating misery and dispensing joy. What's not to like? And you can see, I hope, that Capernaum's eager desire then to have Jesus and to hold on to Jesus and to keep Jesus and to busy Jesus with doing miracles every day, that amounts to a moment of considerable temptation for Jesus. That's enticing. That's alluring. There's a pull about that. A role that's enticing. But then notice with me, secondly, a retreat that's exceptional. A retreat that's exceptional. And I'm talking then about this retreat by Jesus in verse 35. Now, I have a feeling that this passage has often been used as a proof text for the Christian's daily quiet time. You know the kind of thing. You'll have all heard it. Well, Mark 1:35 gives us a glimpse of Jesus' morning routine. We should make that our morning routine too. Now, Jesus may or may not have been in the habit of praying at the beginning of each day. I don't know. But whether he was or not, I feel virtually certain that what is described in verse 35 is not his normal morning routine. You remember how he tells his disciples, doesn't he, in Matthew 6, verse 6, to engage in private prayer by going into a room and shutting the door. And presumably he tells them to do that because that was what his own practice looked like. But that's not what he does here. He doesn't find an empty room in that house of Simon and Andrew's where he's staying and get down on his knees. He heads off to a desolate place, or literally to a wilderness, we could translate that. In itself, then, that's a bit strange. But then there's that other detail that Mark tells us in the verse. It was still dark. Now, the last place that you want to be in the dark is the wilderness. On a Saturday night, I always go for a walk quite late on, and I go along a bridle way near us that's really fairly tame and domesticated. It's not like it's some precarious mountain pass or something. But in the pitch black, even it becomes a bit of an obstacle course. There are roots, tree roots, and patches of mud, which in the daytime pose no difficulties at all, but which are suddenly major threats waiting to upend you and propel you to the ground. And if a Newcastle bridle way in the dark is hazardous, a Galilean wilderness in the dark is far more so. Remember that other occasion that Jesus was in the wilderness that we considered last week. What does the devil draw Jesus' attention to there? Stones. There are stones in the wilderness. Fine when it's light and you can see where you're walking, but not when it's dark and you don't have a Scooby what's in front of you. More alarmingly still, Mark's brief account of that earlier foray into the wilderness mentions another danger associated with that environment. It's in verse 13 of this chapter. Wild animals. The wilderness is a place where wild animals roam. Manageable when it's light and you can keep your eyes peeled, but not when it's dark and some predatory beast could be tracking you unawares. As I say, the last place you want to be in the dark is the wilderness. And so we shouldn't read verse 35 then and think, ah, how lovely, Jesus going off for his morning quiet time. This is irregular, what's happening here. This is weird, what's happening here. Hence my heading, a retreat that's exceptional. What should we make of it? Well, I think it points us to two things, severity and strategy. So first of all, severity, by which I mean it's the severity of the temptation that drives Jesus out to the wilderness even while it's still dark. You see, he knows what's going on in Capernaum before these disciples come and tell him everyone's looking for you. He doesn't need them to come and tell him. He knows what's going on in Capernaum. He has felt the intensity of the crowd's fervor, the people's clamour to get a piece of him. He's not naive. He knows that they aren't going to wake up the next morning happy just to get on with their normal lives now. He knows they're going to want more of his miracles. He knows that there's a role for him there in Capernaum, an alternative role to that of going to the cross, a role whose dignity and worth he could easily convince himself of, because it involves healing and casting out demons, after all, which are good things. You know, there are three occasions in Mark's gospel when Jesus goes and prays in some remote spot during the night time. All crisis moments. Working backwards chronologically, one of them is the night before his crucifixion in chapter 14. The remote spot where he prays is a garden on the Mount of Olives called Gethsemane. It's a crisis moment because he's ever so conscious of a cup which he has to drink, and which thoroughly terrifies him. Another occasion is the night after the feeding of the 5,000 in chapter 6. The remote spot there where he prays is a mountain somewhere near the Sea of Galilee. It's a crisis moment because the Galilean crowd, having just seen him produce all this bread in a supernatural manner, they want to make him a leader of a political revolution. And he's unnerved by that. And this here in Mark chapter 1 is the other occasion. The remote spot where he prays here then is, of course, this wilderness. And it's a crisis moment there, just like the other two. Just like in Gethsemane, just like after the feeding of the 5,000. This is a crisis moment because he feels the attraction of exchanging the cross for performing miracles. This is not something he can just brush off without a second thought. It exerts a pull on him because he's no machine. Jesus is no machine. You're not a machine in the face of temptation. Temptation hits you and it hurts you. And Jesus is no machine. His heart isn't encased in concrete so that temptations just bounce off him and fail to affect him. No, temptations affect him all right. They get under his skin and they make him squirm. And this one does. The thought of spending his days doing the kind of pleasant work he'd spent that Sabbath evening doing, that thought passed invitingly through his mind. It was a severe temptation. Hence his drastic action here, his retreat to that dark and dangerous wilderness. So severity, but then the other thing that this retreat points us to, strategy. Strategy, and let me just remind you here what I really emphasized last week. That when we watch Jesus handling temptation and withstanding it successfully as he always does, we are watching our new Adam marvelously succeeding where the first one failed. We are watching Eden's disaster being put right. We are watching Adam's squalid disobedience being gloriously overridden by Christ's heroic obedience. And so we should watch with admiration. We should watch with gratitude. We should watch with pride in this stout-hearted Savior of ours. And Jesus' retreat here then, it's not just an indication of the severity of the temptation, though it certainly is that. It's also his strategy to resist the temptation. And a thing, therefore, of wonder and beauty for us folk who depend on him resisting the temptation. Us folk whose eternal destiny depends on him resisting this and every other temptation. By the way, I mentioned earlier that moment in chapter 3 when Jesus' family come looking for him. I said it's comparable to this moment here in chapter 1. Remember I said last week that temptation doesn't just come to Jesus at one or two kind of famous moments during his 3 years of public ministry. It's a pervasive, constant reality. And actually, if you read the Gospels with those spectacles on, you will see temptations cropping up all over the place. And that's another one then in chapter 3, and I'm not even devoting a sermon to it. But having raised it at all, it is just worth mentioning that Jesus has a strategy there too for resisting that temptation. What does he do there in chapter 3 as his family come looking for him, wanting to take him back to Nazareth and keep him there under their supervision? Verse 33 of chapter 3. And he answered them, "Who are my mother and my brothers?" And looking about at those who sat around him, he said, "Here are my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of God, he is my brother and sister and mother." Interesting, isn't it? Just how many times in a short space of time he repeats there, mother, brothers. I don't think he's saying those words primarily for the benefit of the people sitting in that room. I think he's saying it primarily to himself. He feels the temptation. You should faithfully serve your family by going back with them to Nazareth. And he's having to counter that temptation by telling himself, by not going back to Nazareth, by remaining instead on the route to the cross, I am serving my family, my true family. This family around me of those who trust in me. So that's his strategy there, and we should admire it. Here, however, in chapter 1, our passage, his strategy is what? It's simply to flee. To flee. To remove himself from where the temptation is. He's much more likely to find all the hype intoxicating and irresistible if he remains surrounded by it in the heart of the town. But out in the wilderness, there's no hype. The stones littering the ground out there, they're not doting on him. the bushes and the wild animals, they don't crave miracles from his hand. Out in the wilderness, he can get away from all of that. He can think clearly and get his head straight and find his bearings and reorientate himself in terms of his mission, his cross-focused mission. And how we should admire then this retreat by Jesus here. It's a brilliant strategy to ensure that he stays on course as the new Adam who must perfectly obey what God has called him to do. And of course, the praying that he does as he retreats, it's also part of the strategy. Later he will say to others, won't he? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. Jesus doesn't preach one thing and practice another. Here he practices that very thing that he will later preach to his disciples. And he prays because he feels tempted. He prays for strength to move on from Capernaum, to remain Golgotha-bound. He prays for the enabling of the Holy Spirit to choose the horrors of Calvary rather than a life of ease in Capernaum. And again, then, it's a superb thing to behold. As Jesus feels keenly the severity of this temptation, he doesn't flounder cluelessly. No, he immediately puts a strategy in place. This retreat, which puts distance between himself and all the hysteria in Capernaum. And this retreat in which he prays. Adam had had no strategy, had he, in the garden? Adam had just stupidly capitulated. Jesus has a strategy. And it might be an unorthodox strategy. It might mean a venture into the pitch black of the wilderness at some very antisocial hour of the morning. It may mean stubbed toes and turned ankles and a few scratches and grazes because he can't see where he's groping out there in the wilderness. But this wonderful new Adam of ours, he's determined not to fail. He's determined not to go down the same route as his predecessor. He's determined to raise by his obedience millions of those who were sunk by Adam's disobedience. And so, this temptation, it can't pull him down. He's not going to stay in Capernaum, soak up the adulation as he becomes their resident miracle worker. He's going to keep on going and keep on going because he has a people to save on a wooden cross. So a role that's enticing, a retreat that's exceptional. But then thirdly and finally, a remark that's enigmatic. A remark that's enigmatic. And I'm thinking then of what he says in response to his disciples who have come to find him in the wilderness. Verse 38, he said to them, "Let us go on to the next towns that I may preach there also, for that is why I came out." Now, the phrase "came out" there perhaps has a double meaning. I think in the first instance he means this is why I've come out of the town. It's the same Greek word actually that we've had in verse 35. He departed and went out to a desolate place. That is why I departed, came out, verse 38. So the coming out there is in the first instance just a reference to the fact he has retreated, he's withdrawn, he has come out of Capernaum. But it's probably also a deeper reference to his coming out of heaven to this world. And he's saying, I haven't come out of heaven to just be a famous miracle worker. I've come out of heaven to fulfill my Father's mission. But how he describes that mission feels somewhat unsatisfactory, doesn't it? How does he describe it? We must go on to the next towns that I may preach there also. Now, that's not how I've been describing Jesus' mission throughout this sermon and last week's sermon. I've been describing it in terms of he has to die on a cross. And yet Jesus describes it here quite differently. I need to go and preach in all these other towns. Now, of course, he's not lying. He's not telling an untruth, because at this point he is preaching as he travels around. But it's certainly a bit enigmatic, isn't it? Why doesn't he just tell them straight? I can't stay in Capernaum because I've got a cross to die on. I've got a sacrifice to offer to God for the sins of my people. Why doesn't he say that? Well, surely this is why. They're not ready for that yet. They're not ready for that yet. If they realize that that's his mission, that he's going to go and die a shameful death of crucifixion at the hands of the Romans, then they'll probably want him to go back into Capernaum and take the role that the people there are offering him. In other words, this temptation that Jesus is facing himself here, the temptation to choose Capernaum instead of Calvary, this temptation that Jesus is facing himself and is finding so hard, he wants to protect the disciples from. If they know that it's a case of choosing Calvary over Capernaum, they'll find that hard as well. And they'll probably want to choose Capernaum rather than Calvary. Who'd want to follow a master to an execution site? And so Jesus protects them from that temptation at this point, which is surely a wonderful insight, isn't it, into his pastoral heart. That he's not loading on them here something that will probably break them, and that a temptation that they won't be able to resist. They might walk away from him. They might say, well, we're done with you, Jesus. They're not ready for this yet. They're not ready to know about Calvary's horrors yet. By chapter 8, he will start to think they're ready and start to tell them about it, but not here in chapter 1. And of course, that's the Jesus who is still ours today at the right hand of God. And still then, Jesus is careful in what temptations you and I are exposed to. You might not feel like that sometimes. You might be thinking, well, I've faced some pretty severe temptations over the last week. I don't think he's been very careful with me this week. But you don't know what he spared you from. You don't know what Satan has wanted to throw at you. And if you did, perhaps it would shake you to your core this morning. But Jesus is this gentle pastor. He knows when we are ready for what. And he will not allow us, and Paul talks about this, doesn't he, in 1 Corinthians 10, he will not allow us to be overwhelmed with some temptation that we're not yet ready for. He knows what we're ready for. We might think we're not yet ready for anything. He knows what we're ready for. He knows perfectly. He knows completely. And he will not allow us to be overwhelmed by some temptation that we're not yet ready for. Jesus could have the mindset, well, I jolly well faced that temptation from day one. And so these disciples, they should be doing it. And my disciples in Newcastle, they should be facing anything right now, wherever they're at in their Christian lives. But he's not like that. He's a gentle, sensitive, wise, kind, tender-hearted pastor. And he's in control, as we began our service this morning. He's in control of everything. He's in control of Satan. He's in control of temptation. It's not random what temptations you will face this week. It's chosen and it's governed what temptations you will face this week. Not by Satan, but by Jesus. He's governing what temptations you will face this week. And he will not allow you to face anything that you are not yet ready for, that he has not yet made you ready for. And so let's delight this morning in this one who faced such fierce temptations himself, but this one who protects now his people from temptations that they can't bear, and only allows us to be exposed to that which he will give us the grace to handle. What a Jesus. Amen.